Hey, you awesome folks. Thanks for taking this journey of discovery with your guide, Keith Haney. You're listening to the Becoming Bridge Builders podcast, your favorite podcast for everything from racial reconciliation to education innovation, justice reform, and leading change in the 21st century. This podcast is for people who love to be challenged with difficult topics, but want practical solutions to solve these challenging issues. Becoming Bridge Builders makes change possible. Each week on the podcast, Keith invites innovative thought leaders to share how they are building bridges in their area of expertise. You will hear breakthrough ideas and concepts that are changing the world. He's featuring guests who are best-selling authors, leaders at Microsoft, entrepreneurs, leading educators, professors, lawyers, and so many more. Listen in to learn how you can be the bridge to the change you are seeking.
Welcome to this edition of The Light Breaks Through. I am your host, Keith Haney. It's conceivable the system and culture are crushing you, and you need consolation. If inspiration is what you're pursuing, you will find it here. If you want your church to be more effective in ministry, this podcast will encourage and equip you to go further, dream bigger, and connect with more. The world is changing, and our ministry methods, not our beliefs, need a reboot. This podcast may stretch you beyond your comfort zone, but never lose sight of who sits on the throne. So sit back, put on your seatbelts, and get ready for transformation. So our topic today is the church should look more like gumbo than tomato soup. An interesting topic. I grew up in Louisiana. It was a very diverse community of believers and cultures. And when I think of the church on Sunday morning, it reminds me more of tomato soup. Don't get me wrong. I love tomato soup on a cold day. Nothing's better than a good bowl of tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwich. But imagine if the church looked more like gumbo. Gumbo, for those poor, deprived souls, is kind of a combination of a bunch of different things. Whatever you have in the house, chicken, broccoli, whatever you want, you put it all in a pot, you stir it all together, you have this amazing mixture of food. It's been described this way by Stanley Dry. Gumbo is often cited as an example of a melting pot nature of Louisiana cooking, but trying to sort out their origins and evolution of a dish is highly speculative. The name derives from a West African word for okra, suggesting the gumbo was originally made with okra. And so that kind of gives you an idea of what gumbo is. But I want to think about the church, a gumbo church, being reminding us of the book of Acts. And here's just a part of, of Acts chapter 2. Devout Jewish men from every nation were living in Jerusalem. They gathered when they heard the wind. Each person was startled to recognize his own dialect when the disciples spoke. Stunned and amazed, the people in the crowd said, "All of these men we're speaking are Galileans. How do we hear them speaking in our native dialects? We are Parthians, Medes, Elamites. We're people from Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, and province of Asia, Phygira, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the country near Cyrene and Libya. We're Jewish people, converts to Judaism, and visitors from Rome, Crete, and Arab. We hear these men in our own languages as they tell about the miraculous miracles of God has done." Today, my guest, Reverend Dr. Charles St-Onge, was born in Ottawa, Canada's capital, and grew up all around Eastern Canada. Thanks to his dad's job with the government, halfway through his master's of engineering, he moved to Northern Virginia for full-time work. After a few years, at the urging of many people, he went off to seminary. Then had a conversion experience and joined the Missouri Synod. He married Deborah with their two daughters. They have served in Philadelphia, Houston, and a few months in Asia. He and his family now serve as missionaries at Ascension Lutheran Church in Montreal, Quebec, while he serves as supervised LCMS mission work in several Caribbean countries. He speaks French, English, and un poquito Espanol, so a little bit of Spanish.
Sí.
Thank you, Pastor. It's so good to have you on my podcast. I'm excited about you sharing with us this very important topic, especially as you think about the times we live in, imagining what the church looks like serving in a multicultural context. So thank you for joining us.
Multicultural, multilingual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I want to kind of warm you up with a good, interesting question. What is the best piece of advice anyone ever gave you?
Well, and I think about that question, I have two answers. One is the one that I think about how I ended up where I am today as a pastor. And that is a pastor back when I was very young who said, I think you should go into the ministry. And when I checked back with him in high school and said, do you still think that? He says, absolutely. He says, you're going to be a great pastor. Then he paused and he said, go do something else.
That's pretty funny.
It is, but it was brilliant because he shared that advice from his own life experience, because he went directly into seminary, coming right out of education, and he lasted a year. And he said, I just can't do this right now. So he went out and he was an insurance salesman in Jersey, in Philadelphia, and only later went back to ministry with an appreciation for, you know, and you hate to say it, but life in the real world, what it's really like when you're not sitting in a church office, when you've got, you know, whether it be a blue collar or a white collar or some kind of collar in between kind of job. So I took that advice and I did engineering, 2 degrees in engineering, and was an engineer for about 3 years before I went to seminary. And that has stood me in good stead, that I've been able to talk to all sorts of people and say, hey, I get it. I know what it's like when you're just dragging yourself in the morning at 6 o'clock and you're like, I got to just get through one more conference call and survive. And the other piece of advice I thought of is from the movie Family Man, which is a favorite in our household. We watch it every Christmas. And there's a place in that movie where Nicolas Cage, who's playing the main character, is trying to get himself back onto Wall Street. And he pitches himself as a Wall Street guy to this big Wall Street hedge manager by saying, look, it doesn't matter whether it's Wall Street or Main Street. Business is about people. It's just people. And I know people. And I think what we're going to talk about a little bit today is you don't want to too overthink multicultural, multilingual. You can drown in trying to understand every aspect of all the different cultures that we interact with. At the end of the day, can you think of people as being people? They want to put their kids through school. They want to make ends meet at the end of the month. They want a roof over their head, food on the table, and feel like their life is worth something. That is common, I have found, to every people group wherever you go in the world. And you can build off that because Christ deals with people.
So you're saying find that commonality with people instead of worrying so much about the diversity of the culture.
I think it's really good to understand different cultures and that we all have a culture. I think you have to start from the question of, well, what is my culture and what are my cultural presuppositions and things that I, you know, haven't really thought about myself. I think it was Orson Scott Card, who's a science fiction author, who once said, we question all of our beliefs except what we actually believe. And those things we never think to question.
Right. So you kind of share with me that there you went to school and you had a conversion experience. So walk me through that journey of ministry and faith for you.
Yeah, so I did grow up as a Christian, actually grew up as a Lutheran in what was then the Lutheran Church in America, Canada Synod. So most of the Canadian Lutheran churches had some tie to the United States, which of course had some tie back to Europe. I mean, that's where all Lutheranism sort of came from in North America. But our church body had really chosen the path of Lutheranism that was more about rebellion against power and less about the authority of God's forgiving grace in Scripture through Christ. So it's a different emphasis on what Luther was all about. So when I moved to the United States, I started, you know, running into what, for lack of a better term, we'll call them fundamentalists, which is kind of an odd, we don't have that really in Canada. We do increasingly. But we're all kind of nice people, maybe except for French Canadians, where they can get a little bit more edgy. But English Canadians, by and large, when I was younger, were just really nice people. And so our churches are very nice places. Everything is very nice. Suddenly, I'm encountering all these fundamentalists, culture wars, Christianity against the world, the authority of the Bible. And while some of it just rubbed me totally the wrong way, I did start to ask myself, I mean, have I rejected Scripture? Have I rejected what God has had to say to me and invented my own religion? And as I really studied it and actually went to another Lutheran seminary before I joined the Missouri Synod, I found myself as a thought experiment doing my homework twice. I would do the homework for class the way I knew the professors wanted me to do it. And then I just sort of said, let's just imagine the opposite. Like, could I make a case for there actually being an Abraham and a Sarah? Could I make a case for the fact that there might actually have been a flood? Could I make a case that Jesus really did bodily rise from the dead after 3 days? And I found that I could. And then I had to make kind of this decision is, do I want to be the pastor that's saying, well, I know the Bible says this, but, or do I want to be the pastor that says, look, the Lord is speaking to us. This is what he's saying. And ultimately what that meant to me was, if I'm going to go out there and tell people, you need to be nice to your neighbor, you ought to look at all people, rich and poor, and of any language and race, as people worthy of God's grace. And I'm going to throw all these oughts out there. What am I going to base that on? Is this my opinion? I think you should be nice. Or am I going to be able to say, no, thus saith the Lord. The Lord says you ought to do this. And this is how he created us. So that was a big part of my creation, or my conversion experience, was sort of realizing I had no good reason to throw out the authority of the Bible, except that it was convenient sometimes. And so what am I going to do with that? And I was fortunate that there were some good Missouri Synod people that came beside me and said, there's another way of understanding Lutheranism. And it took a while, but eventually I came around and joined. Here I are.
Oh, we're glad you did.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to be happy here. So here's a question for you. If you talk about diversity, one of the biggest knocks on the church is that 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour in America. What has been your experience with diversity and the church?
You know, before COVID, I could have said, well, our church service is at 10:30. So, you know.
There you go.
but now we've changed our service time to 11 o'clock. So I can't weasel out of it that way. I would say my experience in the United States has been, yeah, this, and it was a shocking thing. When I came here, and it's not that the churches that I grew up in were completely multicultural, but it was not unusual to have East Indian families in our church, to have, you know, either people of African descent or Africans who had come to Canada belonging to our churches. So that wasn't unusual. But in the United States, it was like, wow, I mean, some of these churches are like, they're all Black, they're all white, they're all Asian. And if I could tell one side story, how this affected, it's not just me as a Canadian. There were a bunch of us who all moved to D.C. at the same time to work on a contract for the federal government in a private firm. One of us worked in D.C. itself, like right in the heart of the beast. And we were talking one day and he said, Charles, I can't figure this thing out. He says, I get off in the evening and it's the weirdest thing. I go down to the metro station. All the trains leaving northbound are filled with white people. All the trains heading southbound are filled with Black people. And all the people that get off are brown skinned. And he said, but that's not what's weird. What's weird is no one thinks that's weird. And that was my processing being in the United States. And the church always reflects the culture. Because we as sinful humans bring our culture with us on Sunday morning, that we would love to say we all leave it at the door and we stop being, you know, Slovak descendants or white people or new immigrants from China. I mean, but we bring that with us. And so we reflect our culture. And so I think that 11 o'clock segregation thing is true. Now, my experience, I've had some great experiences in the Missouri Synod. My very first congregation was a white, blue collar, working class church that was older and struggling. And I noticed that just a few miles away from us was an African American Lutheran church, also blue collar, also older, also struggling. And we used the exact same hymnals. We used TLH for liturgy and Hymns for the Family of God for our songs. But our colors were swapped. So the church in the inner city had red TLH. We had blue TLH. They had blue Hymns of the Family of God. We had red. Well, the pastor there, and I won't mention his name, but he knows who he is. He might even be listening to this. I mean, we got to know each other, and I was going away one Christmas and said, hey, do you want to cover my service the Sunday after Christmas? I'm going to be away. And he said, I don't know, Charles. He said, what if I came for a midweek Advent service just to check it out? I said, yeah, great. So midweek, Wednesday night comes, African-American guy walks into this white, blue-collar church, sits down in a pew. There's like 15 of us. President of the congregation walks over and sits beside him and said, hi, I'm so-and-so. Like, are you a visitor to our church today? Yeah. It's like, hey, have you ever used our hymnal before? This is how the liturgy works, and here's how the hymns are and everything. It's just, if there's anything you need from me, just ask. That was an incredible moment for me. I was thrilled. And for this pastor who was incognito and would had no idea what to expect walking to this white blue collar church and realized they're not that frightening. Like we could do this.
It could. That's an amazing story.
My second congregation was in Houston, Texas, and it's Memorial Lutheran, and it is, I mean, very multicultural. So we have a huge Tanzanian community, East Indian community, Latino, small community, but growing, all within the same congregation. And I remember an associate pastor left to go to St. Louis while I was serving there at the same time, and he came back with his wife to do kind of a farewell Sunday. And when his wife walked in to meet the congregation, kind of said goodbye, she said, I hadn't realized till I went to St. Louis what it would be like to be in a church that's all white. So those are my two experiences. I've fortunately had really good ones, but I've also seen the reality, which is that because our culture, especially the United States, we don't like to mix rich and poor in the same neighborhood. We don't like to mix races in the same neighborhood. We try and isolate everybody. The church looks the same, and it's going to take intentional effort and preaching and teaching to remind people that the church transcends all of those cultures and languages, and it's bigger than all of us.
Yeah. You talk about interesting stories. I remember having a Sunday off one time and took my family to a church in my circuit. They didn't know me. I did like the pastor you mentioned, except I got to go to the restroom and got followed by three elders who were not quite sure where I was going. I wanted to turn around and say, guys, I know how to do this. I'm fine. Okay, you don't have to help me.
I've been to the washroom before.
I've been to the washroom before. Yeah. But you're right. So it's great that your congregation had that sense of welcoming and a welcoming spirit. So how do you get a congregation to have that welcoming, understanding spirit so when a visitor who doesn't look like them comes, that they feel welcome in their presence?
Well, I'll tell you what I think you don't do. Okay. We can't preach about people being welcoming. And here's why. This is the classic mistake, and it's the reason why I think there still is a need for a Lutheran tradition. Our gut reaction as humans is when we see a problem, we tell people, here's how you fix it. Here's the steps you got to take. And what scripture actually teaches us is from the Old Testament, that doesn't work. It doesn't matter how many times in the law it says, welcome the sojourner and make sure that, you know, they're treated as an equal. It didn't work. You still end up with Ezra and Nehemiah, where they're like, all right, that's it. Everybody out of the pool, just Jews. That's it. We're not going to have anybody else. No sojourners allowed. You got to preach the good news and the fullness of what Jesus has done in saving the world. All people. It doesn't matter where you come from, what language you speak, how much money you've got. What you look like, you've got to overwhelm people with a sense that for God, all that matters is that the lost sheep come back to the fold. That's all, and we're all lost sheep at some point. So I have learned from experience, overwhelm with the gospel. Overwhelm, and I use that word, you've got to overwhelm people with the sense that I can't and I don't have to come to God with how great I am or what I'm worth. God's going to do that. So I think that's the first thing you got to realize. If you're thinking, well, I'm going to go in, I'm going to do a 10-part series on how important it is to be welcoming and the 15 steps to being welcoming and the 8 steps to seeing, you know, recognizing that I've got to, you know, if somebody shows up that I don't recognize, what I've got to do, you got to overwhelm them with the sense that God looked down on you and he didn't see anything worth saving in you. It was out of his desire that you be saved that he acted. He loved you. That's my big advice.
That's pretty good. I like that. So, you know, I think part of the idea of being an inclusive church is having diverse leadership. How do you convince people who have maybe been in charge for a long time to maybe give up a little bit of control so that, like you talk about, the visitor feels like they're part, this is their church too?
Yeah. It's hard. I will say right off the bat that I am standing on the shoulders of giants in Montreal, predecessors who worked. I mean, they poured out blood, sweat, and tears to get us to where we are today. And it looks so natural now. You know, I look at my 4 elders. One is from Ghana. The other's from China. One is a convert from Catholicism. One was raised confessional Lutheran, left when he was a teenager, and didn't come back until 5 years ago, the same time when I arrived in Montreal. And he was the one who suggested to his wife, because they hadn't been going to church for a little while, hey, let's go try out the Lutheran church. So those are my 4 elders. So first of all, I mean, I did want to choose from a variety of people. But before that happened, I mean, we had a council that it was hard for them to let go. And what finally brought them to letting go was realizing that they weren't going to live forever. And there needed to be a church after them. I think the other important thing you can do is you're going to have things like this, where you're going to have the longstanding chair of the buildings board. And you're going to have a couple of new members who are going to want to pitch in. And that building chair board is going to want things exactly the way they've always been done before. Now, you can, till the cows come home, try and beat to that person's head. Like, hey, do you want new people or not? What I've found to be useful is to work with the new people. Be there for them. Visit them. Call on them. Say, hey, I know this is a big challenge. And how can I clear some lanes for you? Where I can give you some work to do, where you're free to do what you want. I don't think this is a multicultural thing. It's a human thing. We have humans who do not want to let go. Old don't want to give way to the young. Old don't want to give way to the new. The Slovaks don't want to give way to the Chinese community. I mean, it's the same old story. But I don't think you want to kill yourself trying to get the people that are finding it hard to let go, trying to get them to let go. Instead of prying their hands off of the broom, go and buy a new broom and give it to the new people. Okay, so one more thing. Yeah, so this is another thing that I did at Ascension. When I first got here, I saw that the council was very much absorbed with old church things, right? Mortar, pews, cleaning the building, keeping everything going. And I had some new people coming in that wanted to be about sharing the gospel. How do we get the gospel out these doors? Now, I could have spent forever trying to get that group of council members to be interested in evangelism. I said, you know what? What they're doing is incredibly important. You have to have the building going. You got to pay the bills. Let's let them do that. And let's hold that up. And let's form a parallel group that just thinks about evangelism. And so I purposefully streamed some of our new people that were coming in, a Chinese couple in particular that were just natural evangelists. They were just telling everybody about Jesus and inviting the church. I said, let's form what I called a mission team. Now, what's interesting is I had a fellow missionary, when I shared this with them, they said, well, is that in the Constitution?
No, but let's put it in there.
I said, it's actually in usually the first 2 articles of a church's constitution that says we are all about the scriptures and about preaching the gospel. That's where it is. So anyway, that's my advice. Is again, it's gospel oriented. It's rather than saying, how do I lay down the law heavier on the people that won't change? It's how do I you know, share the good news with the new people that want to do stuff and say, go for it.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now a word from one of our sponsors, For Freedom Mobile. If you're using AT&T, Verizon, or T-Mobile, then you're being tracked. Mobile providers collect your location, communications, internet activity, even your financial transaction. They sell that data to anyone willing to pay for it and provide it to the government without a warrant. Switch to For Freedom Mobile, and you won't ever have to worry about big tech or Big Brother tracking you through your mobile phone again. For Freedom Mobile provides secure, unlimited talk, text, and high-speed data for just $29.99 a month, and it includes free internet roaming in over 200 countries. Sign up for the service by visiting forfreedommobile.com and using the promo code BRIDGEBUILDERS to get your first month for only $9.99. See forfreedommobile.com for details, just like the number 4, freedommobile.com.
That's good. You know, I was thinking about that in my previous congregation. We were kind of trying to figure out how to get people more involved too. And what we did was something kind of unusual. We actually adopted an immigrant family. And by having my ladies who love to care for people, all of a sudden have an immigrant family to care for, their eyes open and say, you know, it's okay to welcome the stranger. And we move so exponentially in terms of just really thinking outside of our walls by having an immigrant family as part of our congregation.
There are costs to doing those things too. I lost 12 members who were absolutely set. This needed to be a King James Version church, King James only Bible. And I looked at my East Indian immigrants, my Chinese immigrants, whose English is sometimes it's their third language because French might be their second. Chinese is their first. And I said, I can't do that to them. I want them to hear the story of Jesus, and King James is just presenting an obstacle. And I said, I'm going to willingly sacrifice the 12 because they can, you know, they're Christian. They can go and find a place. I said, but these other sheep need a place where they can go and hear about Jesus. There's a cost, you know, sometimes we hope that there won't be, that we can somehow just sort of make it all work. But sometimes you have to decide what's the most important.
Well, you kind of stole one of my questions, kind of talking some of the challenges of connecting with new people group. You like to talk about that, the idea of language being a barrier, that you have to somehow simplify things for those who it may not be their first language. Were there any other challenges you ran across?
I mean, so as missionaries in the Missouri Synod, we sort of have this idea that whenever we go into a new culture, we want to know everything there is to know about that culture. I kind of alluded to that, I think, at one point. You know, you want to drill down. I want to know everything there is to know about Puerto Rico. And all the way back to like pre-European colonization, like who were the Tainos and who were the Caribes and what was the conflict that was going on? And you want to, and until I know all of that, I can't really do effective mission here. Well, if you're in Montreal and you've got an East Indian family that comes and then a Pakistani family and then a Chinese single mom with her kid and then a woman from Indonesia, like I could kill myself trying to learn every single culture. So you have to look for some of those commonalities. You just have to look for what are people really looking for and what is worship all about? I mean, I believe worship is about receiving the gospel in word, in the proclamation from the scriptures and the explanation of those scriptures, in confessing the faith of the church, in the creeds, and in acknowledging who we are before God. We are sinners, and so we're not coming claiming worth. God is giving us our worth purely by grace. And then in celebrating the sacrament together for those who've made that commitment to each other. How do you make sure that worship is that clear? How do you take away some of the things that might make it just overly complicated? So can you get away from 16 different leaflets of paper and stuff? Can you boil it down to like, so here's a simple thing. I was having people that were stumbling over singing a hymn, doing the confession absolution, going to an introit on a piece of paper And then going back to, you know, Kyrie Gloria. So here's what I did. I said, well, what does the hymnal say? It says confession, absolution, then hymn. And then I can just stand up and say, and now we continue our worship on page such and such with the Kyrie. We drop the introit out. It's a, you know, not a necessary part of the liturgy. It says so in the rubrics. And we just simplify. I do a lot of verbal transitions. When it comes time to do the creed, the ancient Eastern Orthodox service says, beloved in the Lord, let us love one another, that united as one people, we might confess together our faith. That's the trigger for everybody. It's like, okay, now we're going to do the creed. And if we're doing a different creed, then I announce it then, confess our faith together in the words of the Apostles' Creed on the back page of the hymnal. So the liturgy keeps flowing, but I've tried to like say, if I've never done this before, and English is not my first language, what are the cues that I can give that don't stop the whole thing, that don't make it feel clunky, but that keep everything just sort of flowing so everybody can say, all right, I get this.
Good. Is there anything you haven't asked you that I should ask you?
I think the one thing, and my wife and I went through your whole Bible study, and my in-laws and the Wisconsin Synod are doing it now.
Wow.
One Nation Under God. Yeah, we were like, you know, I think that's really great because they are an entirely white Caucasian church. They and their pastors know that. Their pastors know we got to talk about this. When I was in college, I went to a liberal Mennonite college, and they introduced me to the idea that I have a culture. And my culture isn't good or bad. It just is. It is what it is. That has shaped me and sometimes drives my wife crazy. But I'm always like, what are the things that I think about? Because I'm a half Anglo, half French, white Canadian middle class kid that, you know, his family goes back to the 1600s on my French side, the 1800s on my German side. How does that shape me? How does it change the way I think about things? And how will it make it more difficult for me to walk in somebody else's shoes? I love what you're doing because I think we've got to talk about this. We just seem to miss that sometimes. So I'm answering my own question that you should ask me, which is, well, how's your culture shaped who you are?
Right.
I'm a Canadian. I look at the world differently because I'm a Canadian. It's not good or bad. It just is. And even Canadians of different stripes look at the world differently. Quebecers look at the world very differently than English Canadians do. And I give thanks that I was already kind of bicultural before I came to the U.S. because I grew up with my dad being French, my mom being English, and being able to see that we're just humans, but boy, do we ever look at the world differently. So to all of you out there, you know, they're doing ministry. I just say, remember that we're ministering to people who need Jesus. And before we get too caught up with, well, where do they come from? Or how long have they been here? Or why are they here? Or what color are they? Say, how can we become the best people God wants us to be?
That's good. So I have to ask you, as a Canadian, what's your favorite hockey team?
I try and stay out of hockey because that's a little bit like asking an American, who are you voting for?
That's right.
You're liable to just start a war and turn off half the people. But I, for the sake of my congregation right now, occasionally check and see how the Canadians are doing. And for the sake of my late father, who, despite living in Ottawa for 20 years, was a diehard Canadian.
There you go. All right. Good question. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time. I want to thank my guest, Reverend St. Onge, for sharing this incredible story about his ministry and his heart for multiculturalism. So thank you for joining me on this podcast. I want to thank and send a shout out to my daughter, Sharon, who edits my podcast and makes me look really good and sound awesome on this. If you want to go deeper, you can follow my blog with the same title, The Light Breaks Through, at www.alightbreakthrough.org. And get similar content sent right to your email box. In the meantime, you can subscribe to this podcast. Please take time to rate it, leave a review. You'll find this podcast on all the major platforms, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. I invite you to share this podcast with your friends on social media. And thanks once again for joining us on this life transformational journey.
Thanks for listening to Becoming Bridge Builder. If you enjoyed this episode and want to help support the podcast, please subscribe and share it with others. Post about it on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram at @BKeithHaney and on Getter and Twitter at @RevHedpin or on his website at alightbreakthrough.org. Thanks again and tune in next time.